This week on Making Contact.
Anybody have a mustache and a beard and darker skin, they consider him as a person that he may be harmful.
We have undertrained, under-equipped, ignorant troops. No amount of cultural training is going to keep us from looking like the bad guy to the Iraqi people.
Car bombings, roadside bombs, new governments, and the latest body counts of dead U.S. soldiers. There's no shortage of news coverage of Iraq these days, and yet it's very difficult to get a clear picture of daily life for the 25 million people who call Iraq home. On this edition, Making Contact's correspondents Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib take an in-depth look into daily life in Iraq. I'm Tina Rubio, your host on Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information. Shortly after the fall of Saddam Hussein, Aaron Glantz traveled to Iraq as an unembedded journalist for Pacifica Radio. He crisscrossed the country interviewing regular Iraqis and returned to write a book called How America Lost Iraq. Now back in the U.S., he continues to report on the conflict in collaboration with Iraqi journalist Salam Talib. Together, they offer a unique window into life in wartime.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allahu.
2 weeks after the fall of Baghdad, I came to Iraq for the first time and found the vast majority of Iraqi people were relieved that after 35 years of Ba'athist dictatorship, Saddam Hussein was finally gone. Hamid suffered more than most during the American invasion. On a sunny spring morning, Hamid showed me around the wreckage that was his house. One bedroom was completely destroyed by an errant Tomahawk cruise missile. The steel door separating it from the rest of the house is full of shrapnel. The American bomb killed Hamid's wife instantly and lodged pieces of shrapnel in his stomach and the back of his head. But despite that, in April 2003, he didn't have harsh words for George Bush.
They had to eliminate Saddam. We used to live under oppression. Now they brought freedom to us. We are ready to do whatever he wants us to do.
I was shocked that someone who lost so much would have such kind words for the U.S. military. But across Iraq, I found similar stories. In Baghdad's central Karada neighborhood, Jassim Farhan was living in an apartment building with no electricity and no running water. The streets were too dangerous for him to send his daughter to school.
If one house is burned, you need at least 2 months to rebuild it. What we have now, the entire country is burned. We Iraqis, we need to be patient. The Americans can't rebuild our country in 2 or 3 days. They need time. Bush promised us in front of the whole world that he'll make a democracy in Iraq. So they can't bring a dictator worse than Saddam. If they brought somebody half as bad as Saddam's dictatorship, we'd be okay with that.
But basic services like water, electricity, and telephone services weren't restored. Unemployment remained at 70%. The U.S. military began to send patrols on house-to-house searches, taking thousands of men off to Abu Ghraib prison without trial, the same practice as under Saddam's regime. Tensions increased, and on August 20th, 2003, the United Nations complex in Baghdad was car-bombed. Since then, the situation has deteriorated. Salam Talib was trained as a computer programmer. Almost immediately after the fall of Saddam Hussein, he co-founded a newspaper designed to promote the voices of regular Iraqi people. The newspaper was called Al-Muwajjiha, or The Confrontation. Eventually, we started to work together, filing stories for Pacifica Radio and other media outlets. Like hundreds of thousands of other Iraqis, he has been forced to flee the country.
It used to be not easy to find a reason to be late from work. And I think now Iraqis, they have very easy reason to say there is American checkpoints, they block the area, or there is a police checkpoint that blocked the area, or there's a bombing in my area. And that'll be good reason to come really late to work. Iraqis don't have a really regular time for working now, because if your work is depending on electricity, such as you are an metal worker, an iron worker, or you are like a carpenter or anything that depending on electricity or motorized work, that you need this equipment to work through, that means that you need to really put your time on the electricity timing, which is not really regular time, but sometimes they will know. It will take like 2 or 3 weeks regularly, like 4 hours off, 2 hours on. So they will know from this time to this time the electricity will be on. So they'll go to work on, most Iraqis will work at, if their work will depend on electricity, they will work on the nighttime. There is no Iraqi that nowadays he's depending on electricity, or he will like attach his life to electricity. He will assume that it's not exists. Every single house, including my house, we have a small generator that can run a fan and can run maybe TV sometimes. It's depend on how much fuel that we have. And the water, it's you can't really schedule your bath because you don't know where the water is on and when it's off. So the only way is to depend on wells. You'll get a well in front of the house, and the well will provide some water that's not really clean, but you have to use it at least for washing. But you can't really depend on water 24 hours a day at all. The only way that is, we have 2-3 tanks in the house, and you have to fill them overnight. Sometimes my mother or one of my sisters will stay overnight to fill the tanks, and they can use them during the daytime.
As time passed, life has gotten more difficult and the violence has worsened. In response, the U.S. military has stepped up its patrols, arrests, and airstrikes. Joseph Hatcher served in the 1st Infantry Division in the western Iraqi town of Dor from February 2004 until March last year. During his time in Iraq, Hatcher took part in many house-to-house raids. He said none of the members of his unit spoke Arabic, and usually they went in without a translator.
We use very little language at all during house raids. I mean, you go in with a barrel pointed at somebody and you pull them to the ground. I mean, it's fairly standard. There's no way of knowing if you're getting anyone who's worth anything. I mean, you'll go in and you'll indiscriminately raid an entire block of homes.
Salam al-Amedi worked as a translator for the U.S. military in the northern city of Mosul, which has been controlled by insurgents for over a year. He notes the U.S. military relies mostly on paid informants in deciding which houses to raid.
We depend on some sources. We call the sources. A person come to us and say, hey, I got some information. We depend on that person. So that person, maybe he wanted revenge on that family. He just came to us and said, I've seen that dude selling weapons to somebody else. We just go to that house at like 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. We just broke the door. We just break the door and break everything. We just erase that dude in a very bad way.
Oftentimes, the raids end badly. In November 2005, U.S. Marines raided a house in the western Iraqi city of Haditha, killing all 24 people inside, including an elderly woman and a 4-year-old boy. After a video of the massacre was leaked to the press, the U.S. military court-martialed the Marines involved and brought them back to Camp Pendleton in California to await trial. At the Pentagon, Major General William Caldwell.
The coalition does not, and it will not, tolerate any unethical or criminal behavior. Any allegations of such activities will be fully investigated, and any members found to have committed these violations will be held accountable.
But critics say the military has encouraged this type of behavior.
There are many, many, many stories like Haditha still undercover and need to be highlighted in Iraq.
Dr. Salam Ismail is projects manager of the organization Doctors for Iraq and former chief of the junior doctors in Baghdad's medical city. He was providing the city with health care when the massacre occurred. He says during the assault, the U.S. military attacked the hospital and burned the pharmacy.
The city of Haditha, especially in the hospital, had been attacked 3 times and destroyed the medical stores and all departments in it in one of these attacks, and had been occupied and also in November 2005 by the American and Iraqi army for 7 days, which is a severe breach of Geneva Conventions. In one of these attacks, the hospital had been sieged for 3 hours and end with using live ammunition inside it and handcuffing all doctors and destroying and burning the medical store and ending with killing one of the patients in his bed. And we have the name and age of that patient also.
After allegations of a massacre at Haditha became public, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told reporters violence against civilians by occupying troops is common in Iraq. He added many soldiers have, quote, no respect for citizens, smashing civilian cars, and killing on a suspicion or a hunch. Again, journalist Salam Talib.
Americans, they have no idea about what the people reacting with them, and especially things when some people waving for them or interact with them or try to come closer to them. But they don't know if people are harmful or not, because they have this picture of the person that he tried to hurt them, and every Iraqi look like this. Anybody have a mustache and a beard and dark skin, they consider him as a person that he's maybe harmful. Basically, they are afraid from everybody. I was 28 years old at that time, and most of the soldiers were between 18 and 20 years old. So I discovered that just like, compared to me, they are kids. And I imagined myself at that time that if I am 20 years old or 18, that there's a soldier that, and somebody will put me in a situation like this, basically I will shoot everybody because I'm afraid, I'm just a kid.
The same week the Haditha killings became public, U.S. soldiers at a checkpoint outside Samarra shot and killed a pregnant woman on her way to give birth. The military says the killing was an accident. Journalist Salam Talib says misunderstandings have made checkpoints one of the most dangerous places to be in Iraq. He describes one incident when he approached a checkpoint and only spoke in Arabic.
I have polio since I'm 1 year old. So I was driving my car and I had my crutches next to me in the car. And when they stopped me, I was concerned that when I would try to get my crutches out of the car, they will think it's a gun and they will shoot me before they realize it's a crutches instead of a gun. So they didn't know the difference till they tried to stop me. But when the translator come in, I told the translator that I am disabled. So he don't know the word in English for disabled. So the way that he translated it was, he's injured in his leg, and that means that I am injured. So I was fighting or something. So the soldiers really get angry, and they start shouting at me and saying bad words. And so I decided to speak English after that, because I thought my life will be in jeopardy and they will shoot me.
Joseph Hatcher says his cultural training before deployment consisted of 1 3-hour class and a pamphlet.
It's just like, here's where you are on a map, because you'd be surprised how many people don't know that. And it just kind of works down from there. Like, these are poisonous animals, keep away from them. This is how you say, like, I mean, the only language training we received was a handout flipbook type flyer, which, you know, is stuff like, get on your hands and knees, don't resist. You know, where are the weapons, stuff like that. It's not calm social interaction type stuff.
Did you practice how to say those things?
I did not, no. Very few people did.
At this point, though, Iraq war veteran Joseph Hatcher doubts any policy shift would make a difference.
We have undertrained, under-equipped, ignorant troops wandering around that country indiscriminately kicking in doors, and no amount of cultural training or proper interpreters is going to keep us from looking like the bad guy to the Iraqi people.
We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org.
Our nation's been through three difficult years in Iraq. And the way forward will bring more days of challenge and loss. The progress we've made has been hard fought and has been incremental. There have been setbacks and missteps, like Abu Ghraib, that were felt immediately and have been difficult to overcome. Yet we have now reached a turning point in the struggle between freedom and terror.
In May 2006, after 3 years, George Bush declared a turning point for the American occupation of Iraq. The occasion was the formation of a new Iraqi government under the leadership of Nouri al-Maliki. Maliki, who hails from the Shiite Islamist Dawah Party, came to power in an election that had been organized by the American government. After taking office, Maliki began to talk about the U.S. military playing a less important role in Iraq, with more provinces turned over to full Iraqi control.
There is already an agreement and a plan has been submitted to hand over the security issues in every Iraqi city, starting in June by turning over Samawa and El Amara. By the end of the year, Iraqi forces will provide all the security in Iraq except for Anbar and Baghdad.
Many Iraqis voted for Maliki's slate of religious Shiite parties because they campaigned on the platform of improving security and ending the occupation by peaceful, democratic means. Fadla Shara, spokesman for the cleric Muqtada Sadr, who has millions of followers with dozens of seats in the new Iraqi parliament, says the cleric only supports Maliki as a means of winning more sovereignty.
The Iraqi people should protect themselves by themselves. We are with the Iraqi military and with the Iraqi police if they are run by Iraqis, not by anybody else, and not by control of the foreign occupation. We want an Iraqi army that defends the people of Iraq and not the chairs of those in power or the foreign occupation. The result will be very good for the Iraqi people if Iraqi forces have this kind of potential.
But Maliki inherited an Iraq that hardly functions as a country, with very little electricity or clean water, high unemployment, and regular car bombings. To combat this, almost immediately after taking office, the Prime Minister launched Operation Forward Together, in concert with the U.S. military, in an effort to hunt down insurgents. Results have been less than spectacular. Ala al-Obeidi is a computer programmer living in Baghdad.
There is a lot of military, tanks, a lot of soldiers, and it's just like a military show. They're driving on the streets, they're showing off. They're just going around. They have a lot of checkpoints. They're not really doing any checking, though, just harassing people and delaying us. That's it.
the occupation drags on, another type of killing has increased in Iraq: sectarian violence. Without a functioning police department to turn to, citizens of Iraq increasingly rely on local militias for security, and those local militias are primarily based on ethnicity. In the power vacuum created by the American occupation, those militias have been battling each other. The United Nations estimates more than 150,000 Iraqis were forced to flee their homes in the first half of 2006. Baghdad journalist Mu'ayyad al-Hamdani.
When I went to Abu Ghraib, I saw that many Shiite houses were empty. I saw this while I was documenting the Sunni families who were forced to leave Shaula. I saw many families there that came from Baghdad, and even now inside Baghdad, I can see there is ethnic cleansing inside Baghdad itself. And this is an indicator for this big plan to destroy Iraq into small pieces. And this plan is not made just by the militias. It's supported by the government security forces.
17,000 families are now registered with the Iraqi government as homeless. An additional 5,000 are not homeless, but have fled their homes to live with family in safer parts of the country. Ahmed al-Ahmed is manager of the Human Rights Association in primarily Shiite Diwaniya.
I don't understand why this is happening. The Shia are going to the south, and the Sunni have to leave to go to the west. We have in Diwaniya thousands of refugees. We have 700 families from the last 2 months alone. Most of them are coming from the areas of Abu Ghraib, Mahmoudiya, Latifiya, and Dura. They didn't commit any crime. It's just because they are Shia and they are living in a Sunni area.
The violence has been so bad, it's led many in America and Iraq to suggest splitting the country up into pieces. Two of the most powerful Iraqi political factions, the Kurdish political parties and the Shiite Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, support making Iraq a federal republic, where different parts of the country have great autonomy. Former Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari supported a strong central government, but he was forced to resign. Mazen Lido Radi, professor of law at the University of Qaysadiya in Diwaniya.
It seems the fighting will continue, and we have to deal with it because the government isn't even thinking about having a reaction to it. And I think that is very dangerous, because now they are thinking about settling them permanently in areas where there are refugees. If they did that, that will be the first step in destroying Iraq and cutting it to small pieces.
Many Iraqis suspect a U.S. role in the increasing call for federalism, that the U.S. government may be interested in weakening the central government so as to more easily dominate each part of the country. They note that after the U.S. military overthrew Saddam Hussein, the Bush administration purposely designed the new Iraqi government along sectarian lines. Regardless of the reasons, Professor Mazen Lido Radi says many Iraqis are being pushed to the conclusion that living in ethnically pure areas may be the only way to stay alive.
Federalism is a political system, and it's an economic system, and it's a security system. But now people are looking at it as just a security guarantee, which is the only thing that people think about now. They don't think about it as a political or economic process for them. They don't even care about democracy while they are thinking about security. And I think the exiling of Sunnis to the west and Shia to the south sends a message to the people that it's better for you to be with your own people, which is now the only way to guarantee your security.
The tailspin of security and ethnic cleansing is increasingly causing those with means to flee the country. Over the last 3 years, more than 1 million Iraqis have fled to Jordan and Syria. Boston University professor Shakir Mustafa is trying to get his family out.
My family couldn't care less about sects. They are Shiites. I mean, they are now among the majority and so on and so forth. But they are not saying, oh, it is all the Sunnis. No. What they are saying is that they want to get out simply because life has become impossible.
But Shakir Mustafa says as more Iraqis try to flee, the neighboring countries are becoming less welcoming.
It is becoming extremely difficult. So much more expensive to leave, so much more expensive to live, either in Jordan or in Syria, where they are usually going. And there are much stricter visa regulations. So even when they can leave, my brother was telling me, what am I going to do? They will give me 1 week visa in Jordan or in Syria. What am I going to do afterwards? So, I mean, it's not having the money or the means to go, but now the neighbors are simply not in a position to accept so many refugees.
With the violence and general lawlessness that marks Iraq today, hope is hard to come by. Most admit the situation will get worse before it gets better. Journalist Salam Talib voices one solution, one very much counter to current policy, that many Iraqis share. He believes if the U.S. military steps aside, leaves the country, and allows the Iraqi people to govern themselves, they will be able to recreate Iraqi society for themselves. The situation, he says, will improve.
The only solution that I will see that that the Iraqis will take over whatever they have now, and the Americans should accomplish that, saying that they are come to the point that Iraqis should solve the problem, because now the obvious thing that we have in the streets. That the military, either Iraqi military or the foreign militaries, they are taking over the streets, and the resistance, or what you can call them, insurgents. The only reason they are getting interior support from the Iraqis, from some Iraqis inside there, that they are saying that we are fighting foreign occupation. If we take the occupation out, we don't have a military outside in the street. People will respect the government because they have the power over any other militaries over there. So we'll see the solution by giving the Iraqis more power. And we should reduce the violence by we start as a people and as military to start being less violent. Not because whenever you shoot somebody, you will have somebody to shoot you back.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to freelance producers Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib, to engineer Mike Lamar, and to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Steve Maser. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 3206, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, and Stefana Petrova, production intern. And I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.